I'd like to first introduce our resource people that are up here, and then I'll say a little bit about forms at Holden, and then we'll get started. I want to first introduce Sharon Helgeson, who is a teacher from Iowa here on volunteer staff working in the bookstore, and she is going to courageously offer her story as someone who has been the victim of violent crime and has had to really personally wrestle with some of the issues involved. And next to her is Steve Clemens, who comes to us from Minneapolis, where he works for Habitat for Humanity. And he's going to talk about his experience regularly visiting a man on death row in Georgia for 10 years. And he's also the founding board member for a hospitality house for family members of death row inmates in Georgia. Yeah. And then up here we have Martin Wells, one of the directors at Holden, who has a law background and is also an ordained Lutheran pastor and has worked as a prison chaplain in Shelton, Washington. And he's had an interest in this complex issue and has written about it, especially in relation to the church's response. And before we give each of them a chance to talk and you respond, we're going to view a brief segment of a video that Mark Mathias, our resource and editor person, will show. And before we do that, I'm going to say a few things about forms at Holden so we can go right into things then afterwards. My job is to make sure we begin and end on time, which means we'll officially end the conversation after an hour and invite you to continue the discussion if you want to hang around or tomorrow or when you leave Holden. And I think Holden always tries hard to create a safe place for people to express ideas and opinions on a topic near and dear to all of us. And so we try to practice good manners in our conversation. Things like taking turns and respecting one another and varying opinions that get expressed here. I like to think there are many voices that can be heard and expressed, all in a spirit of love and grace. And I like to think Holden is a place that we can honestly talk about some of the hard and complex issues that come up, and we often don't get a chance to do it either in our homes, in our relationships, in our churches, or in communities. And I like to think that each of us brings our best thinking to the discussion, and no one voice is more important than another one. And together we can perhaps make each other wise as we hear maybe new perspectives. We might disagree, and if you hear something you disagree with, that's okay. The wonderful thing about forums at Holden is that we don't have to come to a consensus at the end. And we only need to listen and struggle together as people of God around the tough questions made especially relevant by the Oklahoma bombing and the recent sentencing of Timothy McVeigh. Please remember that we are all Holden and that there's no official Holden position on anything. So with that, I will go ahead and ask Mark to start the video.
Okay. I want to say a couple things, sort of plug the work I do, actually, I guess. Martin mentioned good courage, at least at the first setting, and so if folks as you walk out of this door are looking for some more information, it'll be right on the table right outside the door. That's where it sits regularly. It's a red cover. It says Horde and Grace, and there are three articles in the most recent May edition that specifically have to do with the death penalty. And then the clip we're going to see tonight is from a video entitled Lethal Selection, and it's produced by the Bunderdorf. Did I say
Ruderhof?
Community. It's the first time I've ever heard of this group. So, but it's a Christian group, several different communities in the Northeast that I'm just getting educated on this that have produced this. It was a several-day hearing in Philadelphia, and we're going to show one person's testimony from that hearing, a lawyer, and he reads a letter from a widow whose husband was murdered, a police officer. And the man that was convicted of his murder is Mumia Jamal, Abu Jamal, who's probably the most well-known death row inmate in the U.S. today, and I don't know if that might ring a bell for some folks, but at any rate, I'll just leave it at that, and we'll show the video, unless I've made everything really muddy and someone needs some clarification.
Why is it well known? Or is that going to be?
Well, no, that won't be relevant, or it won't be explained, but it's he's an African-American journalist from Philadelphia. He was on NPR before he was convicted, and there's at least a certain number of folks that are claiming that the evidence against him was fabricated. And so that's why he's relatively high profile. In addition to that, he was he's a Muslim, and he was with the Africa Move, John Africa Move movement, which is the house in Philadelphia that got bombed and then burned down the two or three blocks of Philadelphia 5-10 years ago now. So here is the clip, hopefully.
I'm a believer in capital punishment. In our society. I am a believer in capital punishment. To be opposed, in my view, is to experience a loss of perspective. The perspective of that which is right and that which is wrong. To be opposed, in my view, is to misdirect compassion and concern. To be opposed, in my view, is to permit the encroachment on the bounds of decency. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, it may sound like a slogan, but to oppose capital punishment, in my view, is to treat our criminals like victims and our victims like criminals. You know, I can think of no one who better epitomizes the issues that I'm attempting to address than Maureen Faulkner. You no doubt know who she is, but isn't it telling that her name does not have the worldwide recognition as does that of the man who rendered her a widow? I was honored when Maureen asked me to read to you a letter that she has written offering her thoughts on this subject. And here is what Maureen Faulkner would like you to hear. On December 8, 1981, I was a young woman of 24 years old and recently married to a man I loved with no bounds. We looked forward to all the wonderful things life had to offer us. The next morning, December 9, 1981, there was a knock at my door that closed the final page on the happy, carefree person I was the prior day. At that moment, I began the new life that had been forced upon me by the brutal and inhuman act of another person. At 4:30 a.m. that cold morning, I was escorted to Jefferson Hospital by several of Danny's fellow officers. They assured me that everything would be okay. I wanted so to believe them. I was in shock and scared, but I walked into that hospital believing that things like this didn't happen to, quote, good people, and that everything would be okay. I was asked to sit in a room while emergency personnel whirled around me. After an eternity of waiting, a doctor in a white jacket with blood stains on it walked up to me. He looked down and he said in a whisper, "I'm sorry, he's gone." And then he just walked away. I sat there until the reality of those words registered in my mind for the first time, and then I screamed. Like most victims, I watched my husband's coffin look.
One of two people in the room, that was a much larger gathering than this. That was for capital punishment. About the weekend, I was coming home. My garage, I lived then in a condo, and my garage is separate from the door of my condominium. And I was walking from the garage to the house. I heard it. And my hands went up to my neck, and I had a cord around it. And the next thing I knew, I'm lying on the sidewalk with my face scrunched against it and bleeding and wondering what's going to happen to me. And but it was fairly late and it was a hot night, and so everyone had their air conditioning on. And the next thing I knew, I was being taken away. thanks be to God and to a very good friend who taught me self-defense, I was able to get away. And he was scared and ran away, started a truck somewhere, a car somewhere. And I called the police, and they figured it was a random act of violence. And they thought I might have interrupted, there were some sort of drug things going on, and they thought I might have interrupted something like that, or that it was just random. And so that was fine, and I had very good support, and everything was okay. Until the following spring, when this person came back and tried to get into my house, I had tingly bells, and probably he was thinking that that would have, he must have hit them when he was climbing up on the balcony to get in. And so he stopped them, and it was the stopping of the sound that awoke me. If he just let them ring, I probably would never have awakened. And anyway, I called the police, and they came, and they got bloodhounds and everything, and they eventually found out who it was, but they couldn't prove anything. And so I had the police at my house a number of times. But it was then that I realized it was not a random attack, it was personal. And then I became angry. Can everyone hear me? I'm sorry. I'll talk louder. I didn't realize.
We couldn't pick you up on the recording.
Okay, I'm sorry. And so when I realized that, I'll talk louder. I'm a teacher, so I'm used to speaking English. When I realized that it was no longer random, it made me extremely angry, and it made me fearful. And out of that, a number of things happened. One of them was I went and registered for a gun, and 3 days later received one. I got a 357 Magnum. I bought hollow point bullets to put in it. He did come back a number of times. However, and I had a very good rapport with the police department. They were very quick response team. It was a fairly small town. And they were very encouraging. The policeman actually took me out and made sure I knew how to use the gun properly, that I would know how to use it under stress, making me run and do things like that. I did target practice for a number of years every week. I would have killed him had he come back and gotten inside my house. There is no doubt in my mind. He was since then went to Florida, was convicted of sexual abuse down there, was released, picked up on a misdemeanor in Davenport, was out on his own recognizance, and within a month had raped a person that lived probably a half a mile from me, and got a plea bargained his sentence down, and is now serving time in a home penitentiary. Many of the things that happened as a result of that. One was the gun. I locked myself in my bedroom every night for 4 years until I moved. The police told me a couple of things I needed to do, which was very my routine. I was a very habitual person, got up at the same time, did everything at the same time, took walks and bike rides at the same time, and so I had to learn, because I didn't know if I was being followed, I had to learn to vary my routine, not go the same way, change the time by 15 minutes or a half an hour or an hour. I was aware of, always constantly aware of my surroundings, who was where, what they were wearing. What they were doing. I have a friend who's completely oblivious to stuff like this. She just, you know, it's like, there's somebody over there, let's, you know, walk this way, or let's walk towards the light, or whatever. And I will probably always be that way. I'm also extremely jumpy. You don't come up behind me. You don't make loud noises suddenly. I jump. When I hear the fire alarm at school, I jump about 2 feet off of my chair. I'm also very conscious of noises that should be there that are not anymore. And that will always be with me. You have to be very careful about where you touch me. I don't wear, this is about the closest I get to wearing anything around my neck. Um, that will never change, probably. But since then, after I came to Holden, well, I've been to Holden four times, but when I was here 3 years ago, my book club reads different books, and I read Dead Man Walking by Sister Preaching, and that, in a sense, sort of was my final catharsis, because you notice at the beginning I said I was a victim, and I thought she got rather preachy. And there were many things I disagreed with her on, but her one basic premise was, if it's wrong to kill, it's wrong for the government to kill. And I can buy into that. Also, she said that it costs more for capital punishment to keep someone on death row than it does to keep them incarcerated. And my point as a victim was, I don't want that to happen to anybody else. Because they didn't take care of it, when I was attacked, the lady a half a mile away from me will never be the same again. Mm-hmm. And that they should, the Davenport police should never have released him. If they had checked his record, they would have known he had a criminal sexual abuse record, and they should have kept him in prison until his trial came up. And so there were a number of faults on all sides, but she should not have had to have gone through that. She plea bargained the sentence down a lot because he refused to take an AIDS test in the state of Iowa. It is not mandatory for the criminal, violator, whatever, to do that. And she wanted to know badly enough that she let him get rid of half of his sentence. And he knew that when he plea bargained. And I thought that was wrong. So I guess we need to change the law. But that's my perspective.
Thank you.
I want to share just a little of some of my own experiences. I very much agree with you that we don't need to create any more victims, that the victims that already exist are more than enough. And I think when we execute someone, we just create another family, another set of folks who grieve for the loss of someone. So I really think we need to talk about healing, and it's probably not healing or retribution. It's I think in our country it's probably healing or revenge. And I guess there's a difference between retribution and revenge, and I think our country right now is more in the spirit of revenge than anything else. Just kind of a little history. In the early 70s, the Supreme Court in Furman versus Georgia reinstated the death penalty, and they said it could only be used if it were not administered in a non-discriminatory fashion. And so a lot of states tried to draft laws, and by 1976, Georgia came up with a law. And so in Gregg versus Georgia, the Supreme Court basically gave the states the permission to start executions. And one of the big issues of why executions had stopped, that it became evident that it was done in such a discriminatory manner that constitutionally the court couldn't allow it. Well, between 1976, when the court okayed it, and then when I left Georgia in 1990, 14 of the 16 men who were executed were African American. The state was very careful to have the first execution as a white person. But then 14 out of 16 were executed, and across the board, capital punishment is usually reserved for the poor and often minorities. In 1980, while traveling to a Fellowship of Reconciliation conference, I was talking with a Presbyterian minister named Murphy Davis, and Murphy was leading some workshops on the death penalty, and I said, if I wanted to communicate, to write to somebody on death row, could you give me the name of somebody, and I'll just start a correspondence, just the biblical injunction to visit those in prison. And I knew I probably couldn't visit somebody, but I at least could correspond with somebody. And she gave me the name of a man. His name is Bob Red. He was in his late 30s then. He had been married. He was divorced. I later found out that his wife was also in prison for a different murder. and he had five sons from that marriage. Bob was mentally retarded or mentally handicapped, that his mental capacity was about that of a fifth grader or a little less. He did not know how to read and write. He was a white man, and he would have somebody else on death row read his letters to him, and then he would kind of dictate a response back. Because of his limited mental capacity, and maybe not because, but I don't know, he had a tremendous fear living on death row of other inmates, that he was convinced that he would be killed. Bob's fear was that because he was white, he would be killed by the overwhelming number of African American inmates on death row, because Georgia had at least 60% of its people on death row were African American. Ironically, his best friend, the person who read and wrote his letters for him, is an African American, and I didn't realize that until 3 or 4 years after we had been talking together. Eventually, he invited me to come visit him. There was a provision in the Georgia law that if you didn't have any visits from any family members for more than 9 months, you could ask special permission to have somebody put on your list to visit in place of a family member. And so I started going to visit him 3 or 4 times a year. We were allowed to visit like every 3 months is what the regulations allowed for. And then Christine, my wife, started visiting with us. And eventually, when we had children, Micah first and then Zachary also joined us in visiting on death row. And it was just a very interesting experience, to say the least, going through all the security to even get into the prison. But to see what he had to go through to come out to visit us was even more stark. He had to go through several strip searches, et cetera. We couldn't take anything into the prison. Even when our kids were in diapers, we couldn't take diapers into the visiting room. And the experience was really helpful for me in understanding that Bob had committed a very brutal murder. He had bludgeoned a man to death with a tire iron while he was intoxicated. His uncle was involved in the crime, and also a 17-year-old. His uncle turned state's evidence and was given a 4-year sentence. The 17-year-old, who also joined in the crime, was never prosecuted. Bob, due to his limited mental capacity, and I think the incompetence of his lawyer, ended up on death row. I met his lawyer several years later, and his lawyer told me that he was a born-again Christian, and the reason he took the case was to, quote, save Bob's soul. That he knew Bob was going to be executed, and he wanted to make sure that Bob was a Christian before he was executed. That was why he took the case. When I checked the court records, he offered absolutely nothing in the mitigating arguments of why Bob should be spared from the death penalty. So the kind of incompetence of the trial lawyer was unbelievable. Bob died in 1989 from the ingestion of metal over periods of years. Because of his fear of other inmates on death row, he would swallow needles and coke cans and bed springs and any kind of metal he could get a hold of, and eventually it would perforate his stomach, it abscessed, and he had been hospitalized several times, and finally the prison basically said they weren't going to treat him unless it was an emergency infection set in, and he died of those infections. While I was visiting Bob, I was asked, because of some of my work against the death penalty, to testify in a trial of another man who was being resentenced. He had already received the death sentence. And in the resentencing trial, there was no question that his guilt remained, but the question was whether he would be executed or not. The lawyer basically was grasping at straws. There wasn't a whole lot he could say to the jury. It was a black man who killed a white choir member, church choir member. And so the lawyer just asked me to come and speak to the humanity of somebody on death row, that this is another person. This isn't just, you know, some abstract that we're talking about here. And so when I took the stand and I talked about visiting on death row, the prosecutor, before I got onto the stand, said in no uncertain terms to the jury, this man is an animal, this man is a cancer on our society, he should be cut out, he does not deserve to live. And so when I was on the stand and talking about my experiences of visiting Bob, and that the prosecutor said to me, you really believe that no one should be executed, is that right? And I said, that's what my faith teaches me. And he said, well, you probably would, if Adolf Hitler was here, you would not want him executed either. And my response to him was that if Adolf Hitler was the only person alive in the world, Jesus Christ died for him. And that's basically the heart of the gospel, is that all of us, to some degree or other, stand guilty, and Christ's death is one of grace offered to us. And it's offered to Adolf Hitler, it's offered to Bob Redd, it's offered to Timothy McVeigh. And our faith calls us to be calling out for that kind of grace and forgiveness. I guess one last thing I want to say is, it was a struggle for us to take our kids on to death row. It's not the place necessarily you want to take an infant or young children, but Bob was so loving. He had, as I said, he had five boys of his own. They never came to visit him. And he cried every time he saw Micah and Zachary, because he so much missed his own sons and wanted to feel the kind of youthful innocence that kids can carry. And he taught us how to make toys out of handkerchiefs, and taught us what to bring in to the prison so we can make balls to play with. He would smuggle candy out to give to the kids, and risking, you know, administrative detention because of it. But to hear a prosecutor say that these people are animals, there's nothing good in them, and then to experience the love that Bob had for my kids was just a real stark contrast.
Steve?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I have much to add to that. I wrote an article for The Good Courage. As a prison chaplain for my internship, I was in prison for 1 year. It seemed to me at that time that I saw more clearly than I had ever seen before the difference between justice and grace. And justice really is an exchange. And if justice, in a sense, is the standard in our culture, then a life for a life is the fair exchange. That's in essence what the Jewish law taught, though the laws at that time were something of a restraint on revenge. But I guess I would just leave it at that if all we have to offer one another is justice, then we're all in deep trouble, because we're all gonna get what we deserve. But it seems to me that the gospel offers something beyond justice. And maybe the character for that is the thief on the cross who asks Jesus to be led into the kingdom. When you come into your kingdom, remember me. And Jesus' word is not that he will remember that one, but that today you will be with me in paradise. And that gets at the press that I feel behind the call of our faith. The article uses an image out of the book of Jonah in the Old Testament, and that's, I think, also instructive. But I think at this point, that's my major point. It might be more interesting for us to talk together.
Okay. Just want to open it up and if you respond or to talk about the McVeigh and Oklahoma bombing situation. I'm sure most of us probably thought, you know, about our own selves and if we were sitting on that jury, what we would be thinking and going through and praying about. Or if you just want to respond to and ask any of the panelists any questions. So, go ahead.
I'd like to see the film clip on the pro-death penalty side of the house, and I'd like to hear some people talk on the pro-death penalty side and have a one-sided panel here. So.
We saw a video at the beginning that was pro-capital punishment, pro-death penalty.
I thought your panel would have a discussion on both sides here. I just see one side so far.
Well, we had a video in the beginning that tried to present that,
okay.
That did present that. And I think Sharon talked a little bit about her own experience of coming from before and what it was like to speak to that issue. And we welcome I made some interactive comments about welcoming all the voices and viewpoints that are out here. So. I think we're all struggling together with it.
One of the things you mentioned, Jackie, about the McVeigh trial, if we were on the jury, some of us couldn't be on the jury.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
By law, if you are opposed to capital punishment, you cannot serve on a jury trial where the possibility of a death sentence occurs. Mm-hmm. So it's something that some people might not be aware of.
Steve, given the fact that a jury that decides that someone should die has to be in the animus, it doesn't make sense to have a jury made up of someone who says they can't. I mean, it even makes sense from a moral point of view, and many of us share, but from a legal point of view, it doesn't make sense.
But there are some people in the community who would virtually vote for the death sentence for anyone who the police identify as a criminal. And so, in fact, the system is stacked against the defendant because those persons are not barred from serving on the jury. But people who would not sentence anyone for any reason are barred.
Well, I think that if you could demonstrate what you're talking about is a bias, and I believe that someone would be removed for cause from a jury if that could be demonstrated.
If it could be demonstrated, right.
But I mean, I think that's the reason why there's a unanimous requirement of unanimity to hopefully remove the effect of that one person.
Actually, in some states, that has changed. In the state of Florida, the presiding judge can overrule the jury and still sentence a person to death, and has done so in several cases.
Mm-hmm. Does the judge need to be believe in the death penalty as well?
Or I don't
can
know.
A judge be a person? I mean, it just occurs to me that it would be hard to adjudicate a case as a judge.
If you were opposed to it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between the role. I mean, if a judge is the fact finder, the person who's going to pronounce judgment, it seems to me that then it makes a difference. If a judge is the administrator of justice, the person overseeing the process and the findings of fact are vested in the jury, then I don't see why it's relevant. Well, from a legal point of view, whether the judge believes or doesn't believe.
What seems to be relevant is that trials like the much more high profile O.J. Simpson one, it seems that the judges, what he chose to let in and how he orchestrated his case made a difference on the outcome of the case. So, right. So you can argue that both ways.
Well, it seems to me that, like I said before, it depends on the role that the judge is playing. If the judge, in every criminal case that I'm aware of, given my limited knowledge of criminal law, which isn't a whole lot, a couple of courses in law school, whether or not the judge in the O.J. Simpson case had some influence in the outcome because of how he orchestrated the case, I mean, that would seem to me to be potentially reversible error, and that's why we have appeals courts to revisit those kinds of decisions. And
right,
they're fundamentally fair.
But my point isn't that. My point is that I'm just questioning whether a judge, by virtue of his inherent ideals, can change the direction of the course. And you essentially said he couldn't if he acted as an administrator.
I think a judge obviously could have an influence over the outcome of a case and how they exercise their administrative authority over the proceedings. I mean, that's clearly true, but I guess my point there is that at least in our system of jurisprudence, the idea being is that if that's prejudicial to the defendant, then that's what appeals courts are for, to find reversible error.
You'll find though in the state of Georgia and the state of Florida, the two states that I'm most familiar with, most of the death sentences come from specific prosecutors and specific judges.
Right.
An overwhelming number, like in the state of Georgia, more than 50% of the people on death row came out of one prosecutor's district in Columbus, Georgia.
Yeah.
So somehow in there seems to be some human bias also working.
Well, you know, your comments, Steve, sort of, I reacted to two parts of what you had to say. One is the way in which the judicial system administers the death penalty and whether it's done in a fair manner. I guess the question that comes to my mind is, well, can it ever be done in a fair manner so that justice is dispensed in a just way? I don't necessarily believe that it can. I think that humans are you know, frail and prone to error, and I think that's just one of the problems with our judicial system, to have such a ultimate outcome as death to flow from the judicial system, where there is such a great potential for error and for it to be administered in such an unfair way. That on those grounds alone, it seems to me that there's a lot of arguments why we shouldn't have a death penalty. But what touched me the most, and what I personally feel convicted of, is how you spoke about grace and how I view the death penalty from a religious perspective. And I think those are two different things.
Yeah, I agree.
Right. And I think the woman that spoke about, you who spoke about your victim experience, I mean, there are lots of issues I think you came to realize around the way in which the judicial system operates and how law enforcement operates and things. And it seems to me that that's where the issues really lie in terms of whether or not, you know, our police are doing a good job, or we as citizens are doing a good job of sort of taking care of one another and living in a way that doesn't, where crime isn't either promoted or allowed to exist. I think there are lots of ways where we can redirect our resources so that we can help prevent crime and not create a warehouse of criminals where society believes that they have to dispense with them because they cost too much money.
I missed the very first part of what was said, but this could be for anybody on the panel. If, assuming that all of the people that spoke are against the death penalty, what are you for instead?
I said it in mind that I was for life imprisonment. And
for the
that is a change. Well, that is a change. When I was a victim, I was very much for capital punishment, and it was because it changed my life. My relationship with men was changed. I had many men friends, and they didn't know how to treat me after that. I mean, I think they probably felt helpless, like, you know, there isn't anything I can do, and I'm lumped in that category also. And they couldn't reach out to me, and I couldn't reach out to them, and it was very difficult because I'd had many, many friends. So I just wanted something so that other people don't become victims again. I don't have the solution. And like I said, had he come back to my house, I would have shot him. And I still believe I would have today. And that is probably wrong, but that was the way I felt.
Well, feelings aren't wrong. I when you said you were for life imprisonment, my next question is, what would be the purpose of life imprisonment?
Keep it from ever happening again.
To keep it from ever happening.
I mean, he's not going to rape anybody else. And actually, the person that I'm talking about has been tried, what, 4 times now, I think? And he keeps getting off, and he's a model prisoner, so he always gets, you know, when his time comes up, he always gets paroled. And I'm afraid the lesson he learned this last time, each time he's gotten more violent. I've followed his career. And this last time, the lesson he learned was, I don't leave her alive. That's exactly the lesson he learned. So next time, he's going to go on trial for murder, rape and murder. Because he obviously hasn't changed.
So then you're life imprisonment without parole or any possibility for parole? What about Martin?
Yeah, that's where I would be too. I met some people that I was really frightened of. I think there are some people who have permanently forfeited their right to live free and live with access to other people. The argument that comes back often is that they can still get at jail guards and things like that. The way it worked at the institution I was part of, the folks that worked in those units that were particularly dangerous were volunteers. They were comfortable there, and I think that might be a solution. But I do believe that there are some folk that can't live in polite society because they are really dangerous folks. I think it is possible to still make something of a life from behind prison. I think it's, I don't think all is lost. I think it's possible still to make a life that's meaningful in prison. And that's, I suppose, that's where the rubber hits the road for me, because I haven't done much to work at that, and I think that's probably where I should be at work, is to take that challenge on. I had this wild idea for a while that maybe the church should buy these prisoners from the state. You know, they're privatizing everything. Maybe the church ought to put together its own, you know, maximum security institutions and, in essence, take the expense off the state, which is one of the arguments for capital punishment, is that it doesn't cost as much, though that's a debatable point. But I haven't figured that one out either. So, you know, if there's jail cells at Holden next time you come.
I agree that society needs to be protected from some individuals. I think to say the choice is between life without the possibility of parole and a death sentence is not a very good choice. There are some individuals, murder for the most part is a crime of passion. When I was in jail for civil disobedience, the murderers, the people who had been convicted of murder, on a whole, were much easier to get along with in jail than people who were in for assault, for burglary, and some other offenses. I'm not trying to say that they're going to be great model citizens, but, you know, the story of somebody like Chuck Colson, there are the possibilities of people having a true conversion experience, a life-changing experience. I think it would be detrimental to society for the board to say life without parole. In the case of the Jeffrey Dahmers, the Richard Specks, et cetera, you know, I think most of us will agree that society needs to be protected, but I think given our proclivity as a society to jail as many people as possible, to make that as the most viable option for execution means that we're going to be filling these prisons and they're going to be staying filled for a very, very long time. So I would hope at least we hold out the notion that people can in fact be reformed, can be converted. Who's going to be the judge of whether that's sincere or not? That's a very difficult question.
In response to what Martin was saying about the cost of inmating a person for his entire life as opposed to getting rid of him, I was talking with John Marty. Is he here?
No, he left us.
Okay, and because I have long believed that, I mean, I don't believe in a death punishment. On the other hand, I can see whether it would be good reason to just get rid of them and not support them the rest of their lives with our tax dollars. And he said it is far more expensive to condemn someone to death because of our legal system of appeal after appeal after appeal, and they're on death row for decades sometimes before they are finally executed, and but that is far more expensive, millions of dollars, which the state pays for.
That's been true in the past, but the tendency now is to streamline the death process, so I think it's likely that it's going to get shorter and shorter, and theoretically
this has been my hope that it would be addressed.
The Scientific American did a report about this about 8 years ago, and they looked at the streamlining of appeals process, and they still figured that it would cost more because there would be a need to have the first trial be so much more careful in order to avoid appeals on because something had been done screwy or poorly, rather than just the automatic appeals that would normally happen in death penalty cases. That's a great article, by the way, because it's just a sort of a compendium of facts about the death penalty. It's presented in a fairly mathematical, Scientific American, so what do you expect? But it has a number of very interesting things. The recidivism rate, for instance, for murder, a person with a criminal background who commits murder as a second crime, is lower in murder as a first crime than any other crime. So you have a much higher chance of someone who is convicted of robbery committing a second murder than a person who's committed murder committing another murder.
But how about sexual assault then? I think,
that's a
really big question.
Absolutely.
Because we're not doing very well at rehabilitation there, mm-hmm. and what we see is what you almost experienced.
And ironically, the death sentence does not apply to rape.
No.
It only applies to murder, and now on the national level, treason and drug conspiracy, etc. But it used to be that rape was a capital punishment.
Yeah.
And what happened is that the overwhelming number of people who were executed were black males, and the racism in our system was rampant. Mm-hmm. In fact, even in the Supreme Court decision in 1985, Warren McCluskey, I met on death row in Georgia, a young black man, he had statistical evidence showing that if you killed a white person, you were four times more likely to receive the death sentence than if you killed a black person. If you were a black person killing a white person, you were 11 times more likely to receive the death sentence than if you were a white person killing a black person. These were statistical evidence. The Supreme Court looked at it. They did not challenge at all the study. They said the only issue was, in your case, Warren McCluskey, if you can prove racial discrimination, we will give you another trial. Otherwise, you can't. And he was executed the next month.
I thought one of the interesting things about the McVeigh sentence was the fact that so many people commented, and I don't know whether this is just a journalism maneuver, but so many people were interviewed that commented that there was no joy in this in this sentence. And I thought, did they expect to have joy in such a brutal piece of justice rather than grace? I mean, I didn't expect him to be let off the hook, but a lot of commentary was about how the mood of the country is changing with regard to the death sentence. I don't know that I believe it.
But remember the scene when Ted Bundy was executed? I mean, it was a circus outside the prison. There was a lot of joy in that. I mean, there were a lot of folk who simply were happy that this was happening. Mm-hmm. That's different than joy. I don't want to trivialize that. That was a different thing.
Something kind of exalting in the justice that's done. But it seems to me that there's a lot that needs to be. I mean, I think that some of these right wing organizations that are popping up all over are, you know, crazies that are. But I think that we really need to look carefully at the anger that persists in this country and that begets violence. So I think that we, as, you know, in spite of the fact that I think that they're wrong, what is it about this country that continues to beget incredible violence?
If McVeigh is executed, he becomes a martyr to that cause, and that certainly will feed into more of that sense of us against them.
The militia.
Yeah.
Others? Make sure everybody feels good. Where there's... My thing is really a piggyback on what they're saying. But I don't know, I like the personalized story of Bob, who was on death row. And then to hear that his wife was in prison and he had 5 children, I just have a lot of concern for the children and what's happening and what's that's creating for the society. Mm-hmm. And what are we doing to help those children?
Well, the incredible dysfunctionality of the whole family. Bob's mother remarried and married a prison warden. And just the dynamics when I visited her. But it's not that incongruous in that he was opposed to the death penalty, and a lot of prison wardens are, because prison wardens and guards are charged with not only keeping these people confined, but basically protecting their lives. And there are a lot of wardens who have spoken out against the death penalty because it's kind of the ultimate rejection of the charge that they've been given. But as far as the dysfunctionality, that is one of the biggest fears that I have. There are so many families out there that don't have parents who are able to instill moral values, and I'm fearful about, you know, the epidemic of this kind of brutal violence and things like that in our society.
Yeah, I'd like to think that Bob was born good, you know, maybe created something evil at some point.
Well, I honestly believe that, and ironically, 6 months, had Bob lived 6 months longer, he probably would have been released. The Georgia legislature passed a law stating that they would no longer execute people who were mentally incompetent, and Bob would have passed those qualifications. Now, what he would have automatically then had received a life sentence, since he had already served 14 years on death row, he at least would have been eligible for parole. Now, I don't know whether they would have paroled him or not, but my read of Bob in relating with him over 10 years was that basically he was a very gentle and naive man. However, under the influence of alcohol, I think his personality drastically changed. And were Bob released into a halfway house setting where his consumption of drugs could be monitored and restricted, I think he could be a somewhat productive person in our society. I wouldn't have fear of living aside of him. I would have very great concern if he had alcohol available to him and that part of the personality came out of him.
Others?
I'm from Wisconsin. We do not have a death penalty in Wisconsin. A couple things have come up just in the last year or two. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which is our main paper in town, surveyed judges throughout our state to see if they wish they had the death penalty at their disposal in the deciding of criminal justice cases. And the overwhelming majority are glad that they do not have the death penalty at their disposal. I think it was like 38% said that they would use the death penalty if it was available to them. Most did not, which was, to me, good news. We are able to dispense what our jurists think is reasonable justice using the current situation. Nevertheless, you mentioned Jeffrey Dahmer a couple times as kind of the case that has sparked a lot of interest around the state, and certainly I think some of our state legislators have reintroduced capital punishment bills based on cases like Jeffrey Dahmer, Jesse Anderson, another local case. And when Mr. Dahmer was killed in prison, I don't recall one instance in the paper, the letter, or any uproar of the state saying, where's the protection for convicted criminals? So, I mean, there weren't many tears shed over the fact that he got what many people in the state would consider some level of justice. And it was hard to feel sorry for the man. I have to admit to having watched the case go through our city and through the papers. Any comments on that?
I think our society thinks it's fair that you get punished while you're in prison. Prison is not the punishment, it's the place you go for punishment. And that's a distinction that we've lost. We used to think that prison, going to prison and being isolated and separated was your punishment. But now I think it's more, and whatever else happens to you there, and that's all right too.
There was a certain, again, joy's not the right term, but the fact that he was dead was a relief to many people. The fact that he was bludgeoned to death rather than, strapped to the table and anesthetized and killed with a lethal injection was a relief to people. Just the whole thing was to raise the specter that even among a community of faith, it's difficult to separate those issues on such a gut-wrenching level. But many of us have to pay attention to things we look through.
I want to make sure if there's other people that haven't had a chance to speak or want to say.
I have a question about how cases come up. You were saying that in certain districts in Florida and Georgia, certain judges were more apt to the people on death row. Where is it? Case tried in the district where the crime took place, or if it was a highly publicized crime, could they technically move it to a district and a judge that was more apt to put someone on death row?
If the judge grants a change of venue, if they determine that it's too prejudicial for somebody to be tried there, what happens? Generally, with the death penalty, it's a decision made by the prosecutor, by the district attorney, whether or not they'll seek the death penalty in any case. And so right from the beginning, you have a discretionary decision that can be made. Now, the Supreme Court ruling says that there has to be what are called extenuating or special circumstances, which means generally another felony is part of the murder, or it's specifically heinous crime or something like that. And so the prosecutor can look at that and decide. And some prosecutors routinely, it would have to be the Jeffrey Dahmer case before they would seek the death penalty. Other prosecutors, almost any murder, they really look for any possible special circumstance. And the prosecutor that I was talking about in Columbus, Georgia, was in fact under investigation because of the overwhelming number of death cases that he was able to get through. And I moved out of the state before I found out if they came to any kind of conclusion, but because the number of death sentences were so high in that area, it just raised questions about, you know, the equality under law that you're supposed to have.
Others? Different?
I just was, you know, thinking, as and even in this room, that probably for me, the thing that starts to become real clear to me, having a daughter, that at times I get fantasies, you know, because of something that happens in the news or things that they're exposed to in other places, and the picturing. I mean, you know, it's a classic question. I think which was the Democratic? Was Dukakis who was asked?
Right. What would you do?
What would you do if someone came in your home and raped your wife? You know, and what would you do? And he kind of went, because he was trying to hold, I think, in front of the public, right, the part of him that is a sense of something bigger than justice, but yet he's human. But it didn't show. What showed was, you know, what showed? You know, what showed is, I think, what so many people, what we as humans, or we as whatever it is we have, that we have inside of us, every bit of the 357 magnum presence, whatever that comes from, whether it's culture or hormones or combination or experience, there is that desire to stop something happening that is horrible and frightful, whatever it takes. And we create those fantasies ourselves, most of us. I was in the service. I was trained how to create those fantasies towards the other, who was going to be the enemy, in our upbringing. You know, it happens. And I don't know what it would take from the church, the people of grace, not the people of justice, to say that is part of our consciousness. It is the Bob Red drinking coming out, which each one of us has. And I don't know what kind of confrontation it will need within the church to face and hold that part of us in some kind of attention with this other part that believes in something beyond that. Because until we do, it's going to be a very vacuous discussion, very confusing for us. Because any one of us in this room, I think, could brutally murder somebody.
Well, and
in the right situation, we could do it. And if you just have a little bit twist and turn around your upbringing and who taught you and what you were drinking and whatever else, you might do it in a less socially acceptable way. So that's a reality. And on the other hand, how do you move beyond that grace to a place where I still know that's within me and I'm not willing to act that out personally, and I'm also not willing to have society act it out. And I wonder what it would really take. And I think, Martin, you're not far off something around the churches. I mean, until we say, we'll run the prison. We did with the insane,
Jesus,
and with the mentally ill.
Jesus escalated the conversation by saying anyone who calls a brother or sister a fool has murdered them, you know, pressing that point. There's an excellent tape in the Holden Tape Library by John Howard Yoder, a wonderful Mennonite biblical scholar, very, very bright, very faithful. Man, this guy knows scripture backwards and forwards. Asking that question because he wrote the little booklet for the Fellowship of Reconciliation. What if it happened to you?
What would you do if?
What would you do if?
In the reference library, too, the books.
Yeah.
But isn't that how we grow in the faith, excluding the death penalty kind of thing, is to remind ourselves all the time that we are a child of God, that we see Christ in each other, those kinds of things. Well, all of our rituals, the older I get, my short-term memory is getting worse, but I need all these reminders over and over again.
You're practicing your responses, right?
Yeah.
You're practicing so that you know when the situation happens, you know what to say.
And the thing is, now, we go visit prisoners at Rochester Federal Medical Center. It's not high security, but we're exposed to these kinds of people, you know, that have made mistakes. And sometimes I see there isn't much difference between them and me. And they got caught. And maybe I could be the same way. But it reminds me over and over and over again that we're so human, and we've got to be alert to our humanness and how we make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, for me, I think that just constantly trying to keep this on my mind helps me think that maybe in a time where I really need to forgive somebody, regardless of what they did, I mean, that's going to be a big challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, now, go ahead and phrase it. If a person puts the words, believe that, McVeigh, okay, terrible crime, as far as I'm concerned, terrible, I mean, premeditated and everything, deserves the justice system, deserves to die for such a horrendous crime. And that doesn't mean that you don't believe that he can be saved, he can, by grace, he can be saved. I mean, man with God however he wants to be saved. But if a person believes that the justice system that he should be executed, is that person not a Christian then?
I wouldn't say that.
I think he probably does deserve that. I guess part of the question is, do we not all deserve that? And do we want to live under that kind of system? I guess is the question that Martin was posing to us, and I think it's just a question we have to wrestle with. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer as much as the struggle that we have to be. What does it mean to follow the gospel?
Carol,
I wanted to ask Martin, because he has the law background, to comment. Somebody, I can't remember who said that. For the person that murders one or 120 or whatever, or 60 or three, that it's then the state does the same thing. But I don't think so. I think that there's a distinction that needs to be drawn between a private act and a state act. And I don't know if a biblical kind of thought on that. Doesn't creep up
the distinction that was made in the back, and the distinction Sharon is making between a person acting to defend themselves in their home, which from the earliest of the Western law has always been approved. You do not have to retreat any further than your home. If you retreat into your home and the invader comes in, you can use lethal force. That's from, but the question we're talking about is, what right does the state have?
The state has some rights that that we give to them, or give to it. I'm opposed to the death sentence, but I think that the state is often has a vested interest in all kinds of things that most people would object to. They don't have that right. It's a free country, I can do what I... And yet, you know, they send in war, they send people into death. So this is really hard. I mean, what kind of biblical evidence is there?
In Lutheran theology, you divide the world into two kingdoms.
Yeah.
Well. And you'd say that the kingdom that is the reality after sin, which the state has responsibility for, and to curb crime and protect the most possible, you can make the argument that the state clearly, in Lutheran theology, has the right to exact the death penalty. My issue is, if I'm a citizen acting within that state, maybe I should try and convince the state that that's not the best thing it can do. And that's where I need to work.
I mean, sort of sanctuary cities or something. may have something to say.
Well, it seems to me if you're going to ask the culture to give up its right to do what it thinks is right, then the church has to offer something.
In its place.
And in a sense, we have to put ourselves in danger. We have to somehow account for this.